Hello, everyone. Welcome to People's Internet Radio, which we're already there. We haven't got Dame Edna tonight, Tom Ewing. But we have got Stephen Roberts. Stephen, thank you so much. You're absolutely fabulous. This is Jill Trebilcock Goes Talk About, and today...
You're welcome.
We have... Oh, Stephen, what would I do without you?
I don't know.
Today we have Ian Lillington, which is who's a local fellow. I've actually been trouble with my notes here. Where do they go, Stephen? Stephen got into permaculture in Ireland. Ian, I mean, sorry. Yeah, look, this is, we got off to a really wobbly start there because what's happened is my computer crashed, and then Stephen had trouble grabbing the stream there. But anyway, we have Ian Lillington sitting patiently in the background. And Leon actually lives in Castlemaine, which is a town very close to where I live in Dalesford in central Victoria, Australia. And he's developing a food forest on Australian land, and he teaches permaculture design. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, he finished about a 2 or 3 week course on and off, going over weekends, with the king of permaculture, David Holmgren, who... Ian Lillington works very closely with. He's involved the Growing Abundance Permaculture Transition Town Project. Ian wrote the permaculture chapter in the Encyclopedia of Sustainability, not to be confused with Agenda 21, and is one of the editors of David's book, I Hear Somebody Rattling Papers. In 2007, Ian published The Holistic Life, Sustainability Through Permaculture. It's a colourful introduction, someone needs to mute, that develops the people-centred approach to permaculture alongside permaculture's original land-based approach. Ian has worked at Ceres, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous place that everybody seems to have been to except for me, but I've seen photographs of it. It's a sort of a little, one of the original permaculture farms, and Ian will be with us any second and tell us about that. And for the National Centre for Sustainability, and with Greener Houses, a project that has carried out eco-retrofits or retrofits of suburban neighbourhood houses in Melbourne. Ian Lillington, welcome. Thank you so much for coming to our show on People's Internet Radio. We're really, really happy to have you.
Hello, Jill. Hello, Stephen. It's great to be here. Thanks for that. Thanks for that introduction.
It was a pleasure. Hey, listen, look, just to connect you with, we're going, you know, through Ireland. People's Internet Radio comes out of Ireland. And you have, you discovered permaculture in the UK, Ian, and I know you go to the UK quite a lot. In fact, I remember when you were in the UK last, and then you came to Australia after that. But you have really strong links with European permaculture, and you even looked into buying a paddock in the west of Ireland once as a possible permaculture village. Do you want to tell us a bit about that, Ian?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's... Permaculture itself is 40 years old this year. So as in, it's 40 years since Bill Mollison and David Holmgren started talking to each other about what became permaculture. And in, that was 74. And then in 78, the first book was published, Permaculture One. That was the first time permaculture went into book form. And I heard about permaculture 4 years later in 82 when I was working in Liverpool in the northwest of England. And I studied permaculture initially in Britain, and around 1988 or 89, I was with my partner. We were looking for a place to go and plant fruit trees and do this self-sustaining life in a community. And Ireland was on the possible list, but Australia was as well. And in 1989, I worked for a few months in Australia, and I met David Holmgren and Sue Dennett, and actually visited their permaculture property, which was only about 3 years old, but it was already quite amazing that what they'd established on a couple of acres. And I was so impressed then in 1989 that I went back to England and started the process of migration with my partner and what was to become our young child when we we started the application before we were pregnant, and by the time we got to move to Australia, we had a 6-month-old baby. So, I still have a foot in both camps, as in I keep in touch with European permaculture really quite closely, but most of my day-to-day activity is in Australia.
Yeah, well, you live here, but I think your mother lives in England, doesn't she, Ian?
I have my parents who are around 80 years old. They still grow food in their garden, which is a great thing. And I have a brother and two sisters, and all of them are in England. So it's nice to have the opportunity to go back. Generally, I've only been traveling once every 5 years. I'm hoping to go a little bit more often. Have to plant a lot of trees and do a lot of good work to offset the air miles. That's my particular approach. There's some people around who'll say they'll never fly ever, and there are some people who say that they'll only fly on for special occasions. So I hardly ever fly, but when it comes to family things, I'm prepared to jump in an airplane Well, yeah, up to a point. That argument only works up to a point, because if there was no demand for air travel, then there'd be fewer planes. But anyway, there is later this year, in September this year, in London, there's a national permaculture conference, which I'm hoping to go to. I've also discovered that there's an annual All-Ireland gathering. There's an All-Ireland permaculture gathering. It's happened in 2011 and 2012. There's a proposed one for 2014, but the actual dates haven't been set yet. But it's one of the amazing things about permaculture is that it's taken off absolutely all around the world. I mentioned that Mollison and Holmgren started talking about it. They were in Tasmania 40 years ago. They were responding to what's called the first oil crisis in 1973. There was a short war between the Arabs and the Israelis, and that pushed oil prices up by about 4 times. So through a lot of the 70s, there was a lot of people thinking about and working on how to live more sustainably, and permaculture was part of the product of that. Quite through most of the 1980s, Bill Mollison started traveling the world, and he, permaculture took over his life that he traveled and he taught through most of the 1980s. Did the best thing you could, I think, to get something moving. He didn't try to control anything. He actually tried to have permaculture going out of control. I think it's one of the great success stories that both David Holmgren and Bill Mollison, whilst they're very capable, amazing people, they haven't sought to set up something that they control. They don't want to be at the top of a pyramid or a franchise. They've empowered everyone else to get on and do it themselves. So there's continental permaculture institutes, and there's regional permaculture organizations, and there's local permaculture organizations. And whilst we are still pretty much on the same wavelength, there's no overall control or direction coming from any central place. So people have taken permaculture to some of the most remote parts of the world, some of the most poor and devastated parts of the world, and also to some of the richest parts of the world, and everywhere in between. It's pretty accurate to say that permaculture is known now in almost certainly every country of the world, and permaculture courses are taught in pretty much every country. And the amazing thing is that that's happened without any significant government support, without any kind of corporate approach. Permaculture has happened because people are truly inspired by its positive message.
Well, absolutely. I remember when they were building a monastery over in India, the Tibetan Buddhist, Australian Tibetan Buddhist, and, like 20 or 30 years ago, and they were so excited that they were putting in, tagaskis or some sort of, woody sort of quick-growing shrub that they could chop down, and they really improved a lot of the soil around Bodh Gaya, and they started some sort of new age sort of, well, not new age, but a very interesting school over there. But, you can take it into deserts, you can take it into swamps, you can take it absolutely everywhere.
Permaculture, is it? Permaculture is a design system, and it's based on some principles, and those principles are summarized in that song that you played at the start. I hadn't heard that song before, but that's a really good way to capture the principled approach to permaculture. The point of having principles is that they're generic. They can be applied anywhere, and then it's up to you locally to work out how to apply them. So generally, for example, it's worth planting trees, but we wouldn't say that you'd plant trees everywhere. What we actually say is, how do you catch and store energy, as in the sun's energy? Because most of us rely totally on fossil fuel at the moment, and fossil fuels will run out, and fossil fuels do contribute to global warming. How soon they run out or how much they contribute, you know, it's kind of irrelevant really to debate that. What we've got to do is practice living with more sustainable fuel sources. So on some bits of land, it may be appropriate to plant big long-term forests. On other bits of land, it may be appropriate to plant short-term nitrogen-fixing trees. On other bits of land, it actually grassland or mosses or swamps might be the most appropriate. But we need permanent vegetation around us to have a permanent lifestyle, a permanent culture.
Absolutely, and you know, like permaculture is really like, in a way, it's sort of making the most of the things in nature that capture the things in nature that help it sort of feed itself. Like, what I find really interesting is about living on the edge with permaculture. Would you like to talk a bit about the edge of the permaculture garden? It seems there's something really important about the edge. And I noticed they've got, you know, a lot of tree lucernes and things around the edge.
Edge is where the action is. That's the saying. Where there's an edge, there's some action. There's interaction. In nature, that can be the interaction between the leaves of the trees and the air. Like, you know, trees work because they have an interaction between the air and their leaves, and between their roots and the soil. And there's transformation taking place at those points. You know, there's oxygen and gaseous matter is transforming into solid matter, and vice versa. So there's that kind of edge in nature, which is where that magical photosynthesis happens.
Because you said you were interested in sovereignty. When I said this was on a sovereign radio, and I was thinking the edge is actually probably where we find the sovereignty here. So if you want to relate that to it, and what you're saying seems to, you know, where transformation takes place. So
there's edges in society, psychologists and sociologists and geographers have noticed this. When my degree was in geography, I went to Liverpool to do geography, and that it was being in Liverpool that gave me a lot of contact with Ireland. Liverpool, there's very strong Catholic and Protestant populations. And it was actually a professor of geography who pointed out that there was more graffiti where there were edges between the Protestant and the Catholic populations, that people were marking the edges with graffiti. And sometimes that graffiti was quite mundane and predictable, but sometimes it was quite creative. So edges can be destructive. They can also be creative.
Go on.
Oh, well, in terms of sovereignty, I mean, you can look at that at any scale, really. You can look at that in terms of your own garden. You know, if you think you have complete control over your own garden or your backyard, I mean, and you have a lot of control over land immediately around you. You have less control over land as it gets further away. So we hope to plant fruit trees in our garden and harvest them in a few years' time, and then go on harvesting them year after year after year. But sometimes in our community approach to permaculture, we plant fruit trees or other trees in public spaces, and you take more of a risk. You don't know whether they're going to get chopped down or broken down. But you can scale that right up to national boundaries or state boundaries, even across boundaries in Australia. There are strong arguments about who has the rights to water. So if water is held in a lake upstream and it's on one side of a state boundary, then the people in the next state down, they want access to some of that water. So that there's an edge effect, and there can be big disputes. There can also be very creative. There can be creative solutions as well.
Yeah, well, I was also thinking, you know, it's like the interstitial place, isn't it? It's the place sort of where all the magic happens.
Yes, yes. And in permaculture design, we try to make good use of the edge. Indigenous people would burn small areas of forest or grassland. Sorry about the other noise, that's going to shut up soon. Indigenous people would burn small areas of grassland or forest, and they'd make sure that the burnt areas were very small, because what they'd be doing is maximizing the edge between the burnt and the unburnt land. In the permaculture design, where we're designing for a most creative landscape, a most productive landscape, we maximize the edge by using curved gardens instead of straight lines, by planting some trees within the veggies, or putting veggies between the fruit trees. For example, in my orchard, I've got roses between the fruit trees. Now, I happen to think roses are beautiful, and if you're going to have flowers around, you might as well grow them in your own garden. But the roses are really important as in attracting the bees, and that the bees help to pollinate the trees. So it may not look like an edge, but there is an interaction between the roses and the fruit trees, and also between the roses and the humans who manage that garden as well.
That's true. And I noticed, David, because you've just moved, you've just moved, and I've seen the last few places you've been living in as a friend of your partner. And I noticed you'd put in some little oak trees for Maureen's garden, and they were quite close together. And I thought, that is so ambitious. That's what I commented to Marita about at the time. I said, I love people planting oak trees. And oak trees are really magic, aren't they? They sort of cut through the edges in a lot of ways. So Maureen's so in love with oak trees. What is the sort of, people are pretty scared to plant oak trees, I think.
Well, for people, I'm a first generation refugee from the Northern Hemisphere, but I think for even people who came here 200 years ago, you know, people whose ancestors came here from the Northern Hemisphere, most of them had some exposure to oak trees and to other deciduous trees. And, oak's a really long-term tree, and it does have a lot of magical links. And so I think a lot of us sort of European origin people in Australia like to put some oaks into the landscape, because there's an immediate aesthetic pleasure, but I think there's a deeper spiritual connection with them as well.
Well, there's both the green man, but, you know, the green man's meant to be in the oak tree, isn't he? The green man's a whole new sort of world that I don't know if we're going to explore today. But there's also something about the taproot or the root, the way it just gets down so far and brings up so many nutrients from deeper down. What about these deep-rooted trees and the benefits they have in permaculture, Ian?
Yeah, well, oaks survive in quite harsh conditions because they do send their first main root go straight down as far as it can, and so that keeps their water supply going even when the topsoil is dry. But it's true, and any deep tap-rooted plant is bringing up nutrients and minerals from fairly deep in the soil. And quite often what's in the subsoil is different to what's in the topsoil. So an oak tree can get its roots down pretty much into the bedrock, and that if there may well be useful minerals in the bedrock that don't exist in the topsoil, but when the oak tree takes up some of those minerals through its roots and eventually sheds some of those minerals through its leaves in the fall, and then those leaves compost and put the minerals into the topsoil. The other plants will do that. Even carrots and thistles and all those pointy rooted plants will do that as well.
Fantastic. So what did you plan on? You must have had a bit of a plan about something you wanted to really get across. Were there a couple of things you had in mind that you thought were important to do with permaculture today?
Because we're potentially being listened to around the whole world. I mean, I'm really keen on the fact on helping people realize that permaculture is more than just gardening. It's actually an international network that's involved in social change and environmental improvement. And there are national organizations for permaculture in almost every country. And it's really worth doing a web search. There is for pretty much wherever you live. There's also a global permaculture map, which you can find quite easily, especially when I look up the website and let you know what it is. But I haven't got it right in front of me. In Australia, we have a small national organization called Permaculture Australia. In Europe, in Britain, they have the Permaculture Association of Britain. For people in Europe, the Permaculture Association of Britain is a really good starting point because the British Association has been going longer and is stronger than most other national associations. The British Association has got a really good website, and they do a lot of international work. And back in November last year, the most recent international permaculture conference was in Cuba, and quite a few hundred people went to Cuba from all around the world and talked about permaculture. Then there's a European permaculture convergence in Bulgaria in July of this year. And the British National Conference in London in September of this year. And then ultimately we're having a Australian conference in 2015. And the venue for that's not finalized yet, but it could be in Tasmania, which would be great because that's the original home of permaculture, or it might be in Sydney. So for people who are listening and who want to travel, is actually great opportunities to see and do permaculture in other parts of the world.
So where did they go and look for that, Ian?
Well, depending on where they want to go, but I'd start with searching the web because permaculture in the country of your choice. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can.
Hey, listen,
I was just going to give you an example. If you type in Permaculture Australia, you will find the national body, and then you can email an address that says hello@permaculturestralia.org, and then somebody will answer your query.
Mm-hmm. My dog is snoring. Is that? I think that's part of the permaculture of my life. listen, hang on. Oh no, can't hear him now. There you are. That's Rupert snoring on the sofa. Hey, listen, I was wondering, just if you were, you just this course that you just did with David Holmgren and Sue Dennett, what did that course cover? Why don't you talk about that a little bit? Because I'm curious, and I'm sure everybody else would be too. What happened when you went to an ashram nearby, you know, the Rockland Ashram, and you had 20 people come. Would you like to talk about that and what you actually studied so that people can get some ideas as to what you do when you go to a permaculture course or what you thought was the most important messages and things to empower people with?
Certainly. What people have to understand at first is that there's something called a permaculture design course. It's known as a PDC. For a permaculture design course. And those PDCs consist of at least 72 hours of study, classroom study. Those courses are sometimes run spread out over weeks or weekends, and sometimes they're run intensively. The intensive format means you live together with other permaculture students and teachers for about 12 days. And you eat local food, and you share the cooking and the cleaning. And this last one, for the first time that we've done, possibly the first time in the ever, we did the permaculture course at an ashram, Satyananda Ashram, where The students were encouraged to do yoga at 6 a.m., to do chanting at 7 a.m., to have breakfast in silence at 7:15, and to start the permaculture day at 8:15. So there was an offer, which most of the students took up, to do yoga as well as permaculture.
I like that yoga because you get to lie down under a blanket. That's my idea of the ideal yoga.
Yeah, well, that's the one that happens just before lunch. So as well as the tougher one where you get up at six and stretch yourself, there's this other one called yoga nidra that happens for half an hour before lunch.
Yeah, I like the yoga nidra one.
Yeah. So I think everyone in the world should lie down for half an hour under a warm blanket before lunch. It would be make the world a better place, I'm sure.
I think they should teach it. Yeah, go on. So
anyway, we had 20 students. They all completed the course. They all loved it. They found that the mixture between the head, the intellectual study, and the yoga and the sort of grounding effect of the yoga, they found that balance worked really well.
But Ian, give me the juice. What did you teach them apart from yoga? I mean, I know the balance is the permaculture. The whole thing's the balance.
Yeah, so
you taught about balance.
Sure. One of the permaculture principles is to design from pattern to detail. So I'm starting with the big pattern and I'm working down towards the detail.
Okay.
What you study on a permaculture design course is you get some grounding in the principles. I've already mentioned that there are principles of permaculture that are general, and they can be applied anywhere, in a city or in the country, in a hot place, in a dry place, in a cool place. And permaculture has three ethics as well. We have ethics that are, in simple words, they're people care, earth care, and fair shares. So we study those ethical and principled basis of permaculture for starters.
Why don't you talk about those three ethics? Because I actually advertised this as talking about those three ethics.
Okay, no problem.
So let's talk about those three ethics for a little while.
When Mollison and Holmgren found themselves with a common interest in designing landscapes that had lots of food in them, because a lot of our energy around the world goes into creating landscapes that don't have food in them. But they said it would be a much better world if we had food in our immediate landscape. So as you're going along the street, there's trees with fruit on, or as you're going through the gardens going through private gardens, there's actually food there. Because we all eat every day, and our food supply chains are very energy inefficient. So they started looking around the world for what they called permanent agriculture systems. And they found that there were, over history, many different kinds of permanent agricultural food systems. But they also found that hand in hand with those permanent systems went an ethical basis to society. Because if you don't have an ethical basis to your society, someone's going to come along and steal your fruit or cut down the trees for firewood or something. And then your food system is destroyed. So what they found was that not only were some societies had to sustain themselves over many centuries from local food, there was also an ethical basis to those societies. When they looked at that a bit more, they realized that their ethics was primarily about looking after the earth, because if you don't look after your mother earth or Gaia, then you can't be supported by the earth. And we are, like it or not, we are still simply supported by earth. Then they realized that, you know, to look after the earth, you have to care for each other. You have to care for people. People need to work together in a caring way, simultaneous with caring for the natural world. And then if you do that successfully, you actually will have surplus. You know, there are surplus acorns on oak trees. The oak tree produces more oaks than more acorns than it needs. There is surplus apples on a fruit tree. You can take 99% of the apples from an apple tree, and you just leave one or two apples to grow again if you actually wanted to grow your apples from pips. You can actually take 100% of the apples from the fruit tree, as long as you give back some compost to the tree. You don't even need to grow any apples from the pips. The apple's giving us all of that surplus, and in return it wants some water and some food. And you can grow more apples from cuttings. So they said that when there are surpluses like that, they should be shared. But that for the, also they said that for this ethical, sustainable system to work, people actually have to set limits. We have to set limits to growth. There was a really important report done in the 1970s called Limits to Growth. And
what sort of growth are we limiting here?
Oh, well, you have nothing grows forever successfully. Things that grow out of control are generally called cancer. And it's, you know, some people will argue that our current economic growth is a kind of cancer of our whole society. This obsession with economic growth, that regardless of the cost to the environment, is what's destroying the, you know, many of the beautiful places on our planet.
Legal constraints and ownership and all of that sort of, you know, individuality rather than the growth of rather than interdependence, the recognition of interdependence. Oh, anyway, go on, keep going. I've taken you off on a tangent.
No, that's okay. It's all related, because one of the ways of defining permaculture is to say it's designing an alternative to our unlimited growth mentality. And it's an alternative to a consumer mentality. Now, in a sense, we all consume. We eat things, we use things. But the strict definition of consume is to use up, not just to use, but to use up. And consumerism or materialism means we are using up the world's resources. We're turning high quality products into waste and chucking them into holes in the ground. Doesn't really matter
whether the ocean.
Yeah, it doesn't matter really whether you're looking at a wrapper on a chocolate bar or a piece of wood that's used for packaging something. We're using massive amounts of resources, and almost all of what we use are being used up, in the sense that the quality of that product is downgraded, and pretty quickly it's thrown away. It's thrown away in a dump or a tip.
Yeah.
So those permaculture principles are an encouragement to put in place a system that is not using up stuff. It is instead using things in a sustainable way. So it's a cycle. Things are cycling rather than being thrown away. Like right now in the garden, as I look out, my partner and our two visitors are using old newspapers to cover up weeds in the garden. And they're putting sawdust on top of the newspaper to stop it blowing away. Now, the sawdust and the newspaper are both waste products of the society around us. But because they are organic products, they can be put on the garden. They'll break down as they get damp. They'll become eaten by the worms and the insects. And they'll actually become plant food. And we will then grow human food in that compost that previously, for many other people, would have been throwing that newspaper into a tip, possibly recycling it. But newspaper is already a low-grade paper. You can only really recycle it into egg boxes, egg cartons, which is an even lower grade of paper. So it's actually the most useful thing for all those piles of newspapers at the back of the news agents is to mulch your garden, control the weeds with them, and grow some food in between them.
Well, you know,
it's just an example of things that are constantly cycling rather than things that are going through a one-way trip from being a high-quality product to being trash.
Yeah, so recycling is just an incredibly important part of, I mean, life is a big recycle, isn't it? And there's these ways everything sort of flow. Can you relate all the different sort of, can you in some way explain how the flow relates to ethics? I know that's a big question.
When are you going to play a bit of music?
We're about to do We're All In This Together, which is our theme song, because Stephen really wanted it.
Why don't we talk about flow after the next song?
Okay, we'll do that. Stephen, are you ready? We're just going to play my favourite theme song, because I decided it's a permaculture song anyway.
Yeah.
But Stephen wanders off. Oh, you're there, darling? Yeah, we're ready. and we think about the difference between creativity and consumerism. So we are all in this together, and we all need to flow together. And welcome back, Ian Lillington. Thank you so much for being with us. You are very humble, and it's hard to really let people realize just how interconnected and how permaculture permeates every sense of your being. I remember when I first met you, which you reminded me of, was like 30 years ago, and you started the LET scheme in Daylesford. As an ethical sort of enterprise. And I know a lot of people are interested in alternative currency too. How would you relate that to permaculture? And also, while I was doing a bit of research, there's this new method. I know, well, we'll stick with that question first.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Look, alternative finance or alternative currencies have gone hand in hand with permaculture. Back in the late 80s and the early 90s, LETS had a big period in Australia. Michael Linton, who'd started it in Canada, promoted it quite a lot in Australia as well. LETS is a club where you barter what you've got in surplus and for things that other people have got. And you use some kind of record keeping, which in the old days was a bit like a checkbook, but now is more often online. So you keep a record and you trade, but instead of you might want firewood and I might want to get apples and pears, and we may not have those things to swap directly, but you could buy your firewood off someone else and you give them some units or credits, and then they have something that I want and I give them some credits. So it's a local currency. Local currencies now more recently are getting printed as actual money, actual notes. And in most countries, it's legal to print money as long as you don't pretend it's the national currency. So we can, for example, buy in England, you can buy a pound called the Bristol pound, and it's only used in Bristol, and it doesn't look anything like the British pound with the Queen on. And then there's a Brixton pound in London that hasn't got the Queen on. It's actually got David Bowie on the £10 note, because David Bowie was born in David Bowie was born in Brixton. So he's a good alternative to the Queen for your local money. And
sometimes he's a bit of a queen.
Well, I thought I'd better let you say that, because I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. Anyway, I love him anyway. Those printed currencies haven't taken off in a big way in Australia, but they may do. One of the things about these alternative currencies, they tend to happen more, and they tend to get bigger and more visible when the mainstream economy is in a mess. So in the early 90s, for example, we were having a bit of a recession, and that's when LETS systems here were at their biggest. In Britain, and there's, you know, the economy is not very good if you ask government, because it suits them to have it that way. So these alternatives are getting more attention. And the thing that's on the horizon, maybe this was going to be your next question, but the thing that's on the horizon is now purely digital currency that doesn't rely on any kind of bank at all. It actually relies on it's money that's made in the digital world. And, it's been most visible with this thing called Bitcoin, but, you know, Bitcoin's been an experiment. They've been test running, and some people have made money, some people have lost money. They've learned a lot about securing those things. And there are now there's one called Altcoin, ALT coin, which is another alternative coin. And that people setting up these digital currencies are trying to, make them ethical and trying to make them, secure as well. But it's really, we need means of exchange, and we don't need to be locked in to the mainstream money system. And of course, a lot of the successes in permaculture are when people exchange things where they don't actually use cash, but they exchange their time and their skills, and that requires relationship and trust and faith. I heard yesterday, I was reminded of a story of something that happened about 1983 or 84, which is that 40? Is that 30? That's only 30 years ago, thank goodness. Yeah. One guy wanted to build his house from local wood. The other guy had a sawmill, but it wasn't a very good sawmill. So he said, person B said to person A, if you give me the money for your wood ahead of me cutting it, I can buy a great new sawmill and then we can cut the wood for your house. And that's exactly what they did. Person B was able to spend the money up front. That may be unusual, but he was able to come up with a few thousand up front. Person A bought their sawmill, cut the wood, they worked together. They both got a win-win scenario. One of our great permaculture practitioners in central Victoria is called Darren Docherty. He's running a great course right now at Bendigo. And over Easter, he's running a course on earthworks, making dams, roads, swales, infiltration, ditches, and all of those things. Now, he got into that business 20 years ago because someone asked him to do a permaculture design. And he said, yes, what I need is this thing called a yeoman's plow. And I want to do key line systems on your farm. We won't have time.
And Louis Bromfield really got into that first, didn't he? Louis Bromfield was really quite a pioneer in permaculture that's really gone unmentioned, I reckon.
Mm, yeah, okay. Maybe we'd better do a feature on him. But the point of this story was that it was a similar example where they didn't need an alternative currency. But the guys who owned the land said, we'll buy you this plow ahead of time and you do our job with it. So instead of paying money, which the guy could then go and spend on beer or maybe feeding his kids or something like that, he got a plow. And in the long term, he actually was able to feed his kids because he kept that plow and he kept on using it doing permaculture constructions.
Yeah.
Now these things can only happen. These things generally happen at a very small scale, which is why one of the permaculture principles is about small is beautiful. You know, we can handle up to 7 billion people on the planet if we have small scale, productive, ethical systems happening. And although
yeah,
these examples
that's what I was thinking with this air money, this, you know, this sort of Bitcoin and those sorts of money. I'm sitting here and my mind's going tick, 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 and I'm thinking, yeah, but the way our let scheme in Dales would work was better because we had real pieces of paper. And then I saw the challenges of that because, well, in Dalesford, we're sort of a total community. But for people to get together in Ireland, you know, or in America or Mongolia or wherever they're listening to this, they have to work out different ways where they can source some of those things, and they can be harder to source. So my mind was having a quandary then about which way is better. I like, you know, the bits of paper one still, but I'm old-fashioned. Mm.
Well, with any permaculture solutions, any of these solutions, whether they're called permaculture or not, there is no one solution. One of the great things about permaculture now is that it's happening in so many different ways. So it's a bit of a waste of energy to argue. I think it's a waste of energy to argue whether there should be a digital currency or a regulated currency or a non-regulated currency, etc. Because actually, we're going to have all of those things.
And I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
And there's, you know, there's upsides and downsides always to each of these things. But if you live in a town where there's a paper currency, like, you know, you can actually print dollars and you can use them. And if it works for you, then use it. And if you live in a place where, you know, the digital world is what works for you, then you use that. Which is, you know, it's one of the amazing things that we're doing with Skype right now. And that, you know, there's alternatives to Skype coming along as well. You know, one of the great hopeful signs for the world is how creative we are and how well this internet and technology goes together with doing what we're doing right now.
Absolutely. Look at this. It's 12 o'clock. I mean,
It is, and I know you're going to go on for somewhat longer, but I have to leave today. And I'm hoping to talk again with you very soon.
Well, I'd like you to come same time next week.
That works for me.
Yeah, if anyone in the chat box has any topic they particularly want Ian to cover, please let me know. In the meantime, we'll keep talking about the ethics. I don't know even if we covered the first three ethics of permaculture, did we?
Oh, well, we did mention, yeah, Earth Care, People Care, and Fair Shares.
Yeah, we
but,
did.
We've got 12 principles to go at. We hardly mentioned them. They were in that great song you played at the beginning.
Yeah, and we'll go there again. So, Ian Lillington, thank you so very, very much for coming on People's Internet Radio. And Stephen Roberts, our producer, we would be nothing without you in our permaculture system.
Well, thank you. It's been a very enjoyable way to spend an hour.
Yes, fantastic. All right. And also, I really like the fact that I get the benefits of your garden sometimes, and everything you do flows on. So thank you, Ian Lillington.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, Jill, do you have a song to end with, or do I just put something on?
Well, I gave you a song. It's in Skype there.
Okay. You have to mute.
Okay. Yes, dear.
Are you continuing on or shutting off?
I don't know. I think we could shut off.
Yeah, we probably could. I have plenty of stuff to do.
Stephen, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yep. Okay, so next week, Ian, I said to Ian that people were seem to perk up the most over alternative money. So he said next week, if that's what we want, we can talk about alternative currency. Which he has a lot of experience with. And also, yeah, it was great. So thank you, Stephen, and thank you, everybody, and good night.